in Iran, then called Persia. In 1844, we had what has become the beginning of the Baha'i world faith. And of course, these days, with the hostages over there and Mr. Khomeini and all of his talking and all that, the world's attention is focused on the country of Iran. And all the media are going on about the fact that Iran is basically run by Shiite Muslims. And this is the dominant sect in Iran, and it's a minority sect in the rest of the Islamic world, the main group being the Sunni Muslims. Well, the basic difference between the Shiite Muslims and the Sunni Muslims is the idea of succession, who's going to be the leader. So they had a disagreement over the succession to the leadership after Muhammad, and they had to split way back then. Well, in 1844 in Persia, Shiite Islam was holding sway. The government was holding sway there. The government was not so much concerned about religious repression or freedom as simply order. They just didn't want any trouble. And of course, the Shiite clergy were interested in everybody following them. And a young man came along and became convinced that, first of all, he saw, from his perception, evil and corruption in the Muslim world at that time. And so he was going to try to do a little reforming. And then he became convinced that he was the Mahdi. And if you remember, just after this blow-up in Iran, remember the thing in Saudi Arabia where this fanatic splinter group of Islamic people raced in there and took over the mosque? Well, they were proclaiming their leader to be the Mahdi. The Mahdi is supposedly a descendant of Muhammad, who has been hidden, for over 1,000 years, alive somewhere, and then he's going to appear on the world scene to take over. And so, various little sects of Islam have their own ideas about this. But this fellow became convinced that he was it. And so he took the name of the Bab, B-A-B, which means literally the gate. And he started this movement to reform Islam. And he looked upon himself as a great manifestation of God. Now he was killed after a while. The government, with, of course, the Islamic clergy going after him for religious reasons, and the government going after him because his followers stirred up trouble with the religious leaders. So he was killed, and before his death, he appointed a faithful follower to kind of be the caretaker leader, because he had said that there was not going to be another great manifestation of God. For one point he said 1,511 years, another point he said 2,011 years, so he contradicted himself there. But at least for another 1,511 years after his death, there was not going to arise anyone in anywhere near his class. But then at that point, the one who arose would be an even greater manifestation of God than he was, some 1,500 years hence. And he taught that anybody else that arose and, tried to be more than just a caretaker leader in that time would be a fraud, an imposter. Okay, so he put one of his faithful disciples in charge. And this fellow that was put in charge had a little weaker personality than his older brother. And so his older brother just kind of moved in after a number of years and took over and declared that he was the greater manifestation and kind of tossed out the prophecy about the 1,511 years or the 2,000 years. And this fellow took the name of Baha'u'llah, and which means the glory of God. Then, he he threw out this prophecy about the 1500 years so he could take the position of the greater manifestation. Plus, then he went and he reinterpreted the Bob's position and took away the kind of great manifestation interpretation of his position and put him in kind of a John the Baptist forerunner role. So you can see the ego is building a little bit here. But the Bob became the John the Baptist, and the Baha'u'llah became, actually, according to their writings, the second coming of Christ. At some points they've interpreted it as the second coming of Christ, at some points they've interpreted it as the Comforter, or the Holy Spirit.
Of Christ.
Right.
That's true.
Right. Right. Then this gentleman went further, and he suppressed the Bayan writings. He had his own set, of course, that he could draw upon, but he suppressed their distribution through the people. And he wrote a number of things, but one of them was the Al-Kitab al-Aqdas. And the translation of that is simply the Most Holy Book. It was a small book, and it was taught by him to be the most holy of his writings, and literally their Bible, or their replacement for the Quran. And a replacement for the Quran, for the Bayan, for the Bible, and all this. And he taught that for 1,000 years, and it was written in Arabic, as the Quran was, and the language of the Persian people, although it uses the Arabic script, is Farsi. Which, you know, it's a different language, like German is different than English, even though they use the same alphabet. So then they had a Bible, as it were. Now, he then set down rules for the succession, as to who was going to succeed him. And he named two of his sons to succeed him. And Abdu'l-Baha was supposed to succeed him first, and then after Abdu'l-Baha, Abdu'l-Baha's younger brother was supposed to come in the succession and be the leader of the movement. So on Baha'u'llah's passing, first of all, there was a big falling out between Abdu'l-Baha and his younger brother, and the younger brother got kicked out of the succession, despite the actual last will and testament of Baha'u'llah. Then Abdu'l-Baha, although at one point he even talked about the Most Holy Book and how it should be followed, started suppressing the Most Holy Book and, you know, destroying copies and getting them out of the hands, making sure it wasn't translated and all of this. Then he came out. He really conceived the idea that, hey, you know, we've got to go farther here than a reform movement in Islam. We've got to have a new world religion. And this is the reason that he suppressed the Al-Kitab al-Aqdas, because the Al-Kitab al-Aqdas, in its theology, the Most Holy Book in its theology and in its ethics and all this, was very much like the Quran. And they, you know, they thought, well, this is just too harsh, and it's not modern enough, and it's not going to go in the Western world. So we'll be looking back at this in a bit to follow it through. But okay, Baha'u'llah died in 1892. Right, 1844, the first guy, then he went on for a few years, and then there was a few years after him until Baha'u'llah took over. Baha'u'llah died in 1892. And so this guy was in charge, you know, up till about 1920. So he wanted to sell this scheme to the rest of the world, so he wanted to come out with a new modern religion. And so he laid out the 10 principles, and these 10 principles, with just minor rewording and all, are put out by the Baha'is today, and they're much quoted, and you can get a lot of their little leaflet literature that mentions the 10 principles. The first principle is the independent investigation of truth. So this is a principle that they supposedly believe in and push. The second principle is the oneness of humanity, the oneness of the human race. Third, international peace. Four, conformity of religion to science and reason. Therefore, anything in our religion and our theology and our belief, you know, has to conform with science and reason. Five is abolition of religious, racial, and patriotic prejudice. In other words, nationalistic prejudice, racial prejudice, religious prejudice should cease. Six is equality of... Number seven, yeah, they were a little ahead of ERA on that. Number seven, working together of social classes in love and harmony. All classes of society are to work together in love and harmony. Number eight is the establishment of a, what they term a parliament of man as a court of last appeal in international questions. So they're supposed to, you're supposed to wipe out religious, racial, and patriotic prejudice. The nations are supposed to cooperate, but if for any reason there's still friction, there's still a question, there should be this parliament of man to settle the problems. Number nine is universal education. Number 10 is universal language. And they don't push the universal language thing so much anymore because they were pushing Esperanto as a universal language at one time, and that just really didn't go. And so they've gotten just a little more, you know, they still have it in their 10 principles, but they've gotten a little more silent about it. I don't know whether they're now, you know, going to reinterpret this and start pushing English as a universal language or what. Oh, yes. So this was quite a departure from Islam. And that's why he suppressed this most holy book, because the most holy book still looked too close to Islam for him, even though, you know, his dad said, this is it, this is the word of God for the next 1,000 years, and everybody's got to believe it. So he made the move, Abdu'l-Bahá made the move to switch this away from an Islamic sect to a world religion. Even though to do that, he had to be quite unfaithful to the founders of the faith, both the Bab and his father, Baha'u'llah. And a lot of cover-up there because, you know, first of all, the Bab was supposed to be it, then Baha'u'llah is supposed to be it, and supposed to be this great manifestation of God and lay out the authoritative writings, and then they have to cover some of them up. Well, this actually leaned closer towards a completely syncretistic thing, a combination of kind of humanism and drawing from Muhammad and Buddha and Christianity and all of them together. In fact, you see this symbolized in their temple up in Wilmette, Illinois, just north of Chicago by Lake Michigan. They have a temple, very beautiful structure, nine sides. And nine doors. And these nine sides and nine doors are supposed to represent the nine great prophets from human history. And so... Yeah, yeah. Right, very fancy, nice gardens around it and the whole works. It's really a show place. But nine is a very important number to them, and they identify the number nine with nine great prophets of the world, which includes, you know, Buddha, and Muhammad, and Christ, and Moses, and Zoroaster, and I forget who all else. But these are supposed to be the nine great prophets, and they kind of line up their greatness. In other words, God reveals things progressively, according to them, so each prophet is subsequently greater than the ones before. So therefore, you know, Christ was a greater prophet than, say, Moses. But then Muhammad, since he's later, becomes a greater prophet than Christ. But then Baha'u'llah is the latest, and therefore the greatest, of all the prophets. So they line it up that way. Now, we'll be referring back to these principles in a few minutes. But let's go on a little bit with the history and the layout of the organization. So... Abdu'l-Bahá carried this on, And there was a history here. First of all, there was a history between Baha'u'llah and his younger brother, who was the legitimate successor to the Bab, of family infighting and, you know, literally very poor behavior towards each other. Then with Abdul Baha and his brother, it seemed like every time the new man took over, most of the other family members were excommunicated, and sometimes they were, you know, jailed or killed. So all these principles of humanitarian practices and all that seemed to fall by the wayside every time there was a new succession, a new changing of the guard. But when Abdul Baha, well, first of all, Abdul Baha was under kind of a house arrest from the Turkish government, because Turkey was kind of running that part of the world in those days. And there was just too much strife between various factions of the movement, so the Turkish government, you know, take the various leaders and kind of spread them out and say, now, okay, you know, as long as you live in this city and don't go out of that province, fine. Otherwise, we'll nail you. So it was kind of not exactly a prison existence, but kind of restricted to at least a locale. And so in 1908, there was a liberalization, and he was allowed to travel anywhere he wanted. So he came to America. They already had a few followers in America. He came to America, and he did a tour, and he came out, and he dedicated the site for the temple in Wilmette. And he publicized the 10 principles, and he caused quite a stir in the United States. And even up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, north of Chicago and south of Milwaukee, they had a pocket of followers back as early as 1912. Now, he named, he abrogated his father's will, and in his will named his grandson, Shoghi Effendi, as the guardian of the cause. And then stated furthermore that there should always be a guardian of the cause, and each guardian should appoint his own successor. And then this man was the infallible interpreter of the writings of Baha'u'llah and Abdul Baha, and had control there through being the one and only legitimate interpreter. So Shoghi Effendi took over in approximately 1920, and ruled the movement until his death in 1957. And in 1957, despite his father's will and his father's writings and all that, you know, before he died, he did not name a successor. And so they had a little crisis there, and technically speaking, you know, they should have been out of business, but with no successor there. But they set up, after his death, they set up a 9-man board, the 9 hands of the cause. And these fellows rule the operation from Haifa, Israel. And so this becomes a self-perpetuating body now, and will, you know, probably go on. But each time they've had these successions, and they've had to, break wills and break writings and break doctrine and things that have been laid down in the past, there have been some splinter groups, and some people have objected. So there are, you know, various parties in the world today that some of them have not been able to survive as organizations, but they've gotten very upset when these supposedly sacred commandments have been broken one after the other. The majority of the people in the movement are just totally unaware of this. There's been quite a suppression of this information. But let's go back to these 10 principles and key in on the first of these 10, the independent investigation of truth. Now, it would seem that while that sounds very nice, there's been a great breaking of this through the failure to publish and translate the Al-Kitab al-Aqdas, the Most Holy Book, and make that available to the Baha'i people, because according to their founder, according to this great manifestation of God, the greatest of the 9 great prophets of history, These people are supposed to study this book and follow it, and it's supposed to be the infallible rule for 1,000 years. And most of them don't even know that it exists. And those that know it exists have never seen a copy. There's only a handful of copies in all the world, and they're in Arabic, and they're not letting them out. And they're certainly not translating it into English. So back about 15, 20 years ago, a Christian missionary to Iran from the Presbyterian Church, been laboring in Iran back since about 1920. He and this man had made it his point not only to be a missionary to the Islamic people in Iran, but also to become quite an authority on the Baha'i faith. And today he is the top evangelical Christian authority in the world on the Baha'i faith. Name is William McElwee Miller. He and another scholar set out and translated this most holy book into English, simply so it would be available. And they earned the wrath of the Baha'i faith for doing this. And unfortunately, it's still not that available. It's still very hard to come by a copy, but at least it is in existence and it's in the English language. So there's the suppression of their own supposed Bible. There's also been a suppression of their history and the strife and the setting aside of doctrines and writings and setting aside in the successor line and all this every time they've had new leaders succeeding. And this suppression of information for many years was so complete that even Christian scholars who, let's face it, are going to be somewhat, you know, critical of the other religion, were unaware of what was going on. So they were criticizing the Baha'i faith strictly on what they saw today and from the authorized histories and from the doctrine that the Baha'is are teaching. But the whole historical cover-up and the major doctrinal switches and the cover-up of that was so well hidden that even critical scholars from all over the world didn't come up with this. But Miller got the information together and has made it available. The other principles, as you can see, hey, you know, there's some pretty fine things here. You could take this, you know, you could say, well, these are commonly agreed upon principles that we as Christians can go with too, at least certain of them are. You can say, well, some of these things are coming from the Bible. But it becomes kind of a PR thing for them. There's some theology here, some belief here, but very much it's a PR type thing. And it becomes a blending of humanism with their theology. But okay, where are they actually at theologically? Say, well, they affirm Jesus as a prophet, but they deny his uniqueness. They affirm that Muhammad was a greater prophet and Baha'u'llah was a greater prophet yet. They deny Christ's sinlessness, and they deny his physical resurrection. And in the book, Some Answered Questions by Abdu'l-Baha, I want to read a little bit about their view of the resurrection of Christ. Now, this book is a somewhat of a classic. If you're looking at the Baha'i faith and you want to say, now, what do they do with the Bible? How do they interpret the Bible? Well, they've got some other things to do a little of this too, but this book has got a lot of their material on that because Abdu'l-Baha did a lot of writing. And they collected and translated this from the Persian and put it out to the Baha'i Publishing Trust up in Wilmette. Abdu'l-Baha says, therefore we say that the meaning of Christ's resurrection is as follows. The disciples were troubled and agitated after the martyrdom of Christ. The reality of Christ, which signifies his teachings, his bounties, his perfections, and his spiritual power, was hidden and concealed for 2 or 3 days after his martyrdom and was not resplendent and manifest. No, rather it was lost, for the believers were few in number and were troubled and agitated. The cause of Christ was like a lifeless body, And when after 3 days the disciples became assured and steadfast and began to serve the cause of Christ and resolved to spread the divine teachings, putting his counsels into practice and rising to serve him, the reality of Christ became resplendent and his bounty appeared. His religion found life, his teachings and his admonitions became evident and visible. In other words, the cause of Christ was like a lifeless body until the life and the bounty of the Holy Spirit surrounded it. In other words, to them, Christ's resurrection, the resurrection account in the Bible, is simply a symbolic account of the disciples coming out of their despair and going on and teaching and preaching in Christ's memory. No, there's another group that claims that they, it's a related group, though. That's the Ahmadiyya movement in Islam that claims that they found Christ's grave in India. But these people, again, you know, figure, okay, Christ died, still dead, and the resurrection accounts should really be interpreted not physically, but hey, you know, after 2 or 3 days, his disciples finally pulled themselves together and went on to teach the principles which Christ taught. Now also, you find in here accounts of their taking the Holy Spirit verses, like John 14:26, John 15:26, and saying, applying this to Abdu'l-Baha, that you know, he was the comforter that Christ was promising. So you see an apparent affirmation of a bunch of prophets, including Buddha and Zoroaster, but then drawing it under and saying, well, Baha'u'llah is the final prophet. None of these prophets were in finally authoritative. Certainly none of them were sinless. None of them were God incarnate, although Baha'u'llah was closer than the rest. And so then there is a teaching of, first of all, belief in this system of nine prophets and belief in Baha'u'llah, adherence to the cause, and then under the interpretation of the nine hands of the cause and the interpretation of the writings of these people, the following of these 10 principles. And they're very fuzzy about thoughts of afterlife, and they're very, very fuzzy about thoughts of punishment for sin. But they do make it clear that through right living, through treating your fellow man properly, through education, through charitable works, etc., etc., this is the way that you're going to take care of your problems. And they're actually looking towards an ideal society on earth. And in fact, in some of their teachings, you're trying to figure out, you know, where are they at in terms of an afterlife, and it's hard to draw a conclusion as to whether they believe in much of an afterlife at all. But they're definitely believing in, you know, kind of an almost heaven on earth, reachable through human efforts under the inspiration of their religion.
No reincarnation.
No. Again, they get real fuzzy in that whole area, but they're not teaching it dogmatically and, you know, coming back in a series like the Eastern groups are. But they have not, you know, they have not come to grips with sin. They've denied the deity of Christ. They've denied the physical resurrection of Christ. Salvation through his blood. These things are all set aside. His miracles are denied, his healing miracles. They say, listen, well, this is not in conformity with reason and science. Therefore, we'll throw it out. Now, that's an interesting thing, because they would do that with all of the previous prophets. But with Baha'u'llah, they teach that he was he was miraculously saved as they were trying to execute him, you know, that this firing squad was banging away at him and banging away at him, and the bullets bounced off of him, and finally the bullets cut the ropes that were holding him, and he ran away. But then, of course, later they caught him and killed him. So only the latest and greatest prophet, you know, actually had supernatural miracles type thing. And the other prophets were great men and great examples and great teachers, but nothing supernatural going on there, including the case of Christ. So we're faced with these people today. They, because they value education, they're to be found in well-to-do communities, they're to be found a lot around college campuses, and they have little gatherings called firesides. And this is their basic meeting group, and where they meet for sharing of the principles of Baha'i, and sharing of some of these writings, and talking things over, sharing experiences. In 1978, they made a real push, a real missionary effort, and each of their local fireside groups was advised from national headquarters that everybody in the fireside should be a missionary for Baha'i that year and try to bring people into the Baha'i faith, and that each local fireside should develop a strategy for advertising the movement, advertising in newspapers and holding public talks and advertising in magazines and all of these things. So they put this big push on through 78, and in 1979, early 1979, they made a move like they were going to continue it, but at least from my observations, it seems to have died out somewhat. Now, they're still out there, and they're still active, and they're still holding public meetings, but they don't seem to be quite as visible and advertising quite as heavily as they were through 78 in the first two or three months of this year. Trying to go back, and I had some membership figures that were a few years old, and I don't recall what they were now. I had the little disaster happen as I left Milwaukee and came down here. I brought notes on every group except Baha'i. Somehow I lost my Baha'i notes in there. Fortunately, I brought along some of the source materials, but I left my lecture notes behind. But they are spread throughout the world, generally not in large numbers, though. They're still in Iran, and I'm sure under the Ayatollah, they're having a lot of difficulty over there, because they've been somewhat of a, not always actively persecuted, but somewhat of a occasionally persecuted religion in Iran ever since their founding. And they've made a lot of this in terms of propaganda. There were times when there were quite a few martyrdoms for the Baha'i faith in Iran. And, times it even numbered into the thousands. And when it numbered into the thousands, of course, they inflated the figure into the hundreds of thousands. And times when five or six people died for the Baha'i faith, why, this kind of got exaggerated too. But in general, they have had a difficult time in Iran, because the Islamic religion is just not that tolerant. And especially if something that's come out of Islam, and they figure, it's a direct offshoot and heretical, the pressure is always on them. So, well, every group except the Shiites is small in Iran. Now, the Kurds, okay, the majority of your population is Shiite, whether they're Persians or whether they're Azerbaijanis, the Turkish people. The Kurds are the largest Sunni population in Iran, and they're Islamic people also. Well, then you start getting down to Christians and Jews and Baha'is. The Baha'is out of those three are probably the largest group, and Jews and Christians maybe running neck and neck, or a few more Jewish people than Christians there. But it's not one of the fun places of the world to be in a religious minority, I'll tell you. Well, I've tried to follow it a little bit from the newspapers and all. It's hard to say how far that's going to go. The one thing it's going to do, whether that becomes big in itself or not, the one thing it's going to do is it's going to kind of fuel the fires all over, because there are other minority groups and little provinces around Iran that are wanting more self-rule or wanting independence, and I would think it's going to be harder to keep down the Kurds now. Because this fellow, I forget his name, Shariat, the Ayatollah that heads the Azerbaijanis, he's more moderate in many ways than Khomeini. He's a Shiite Muslim also, but he's more moderate in many ways. He does not have his own army, his own military force, and he just doesn't get into that type of stuff too much. But the people there seem to be willing to follow him anyway. And so if Khomeini pushes him too far and he decides it's, you know, no more Mr. Nice Guy, it could get kind of rough over there. And I've been kind of expecting more trouble in Kurdistan. It's a title. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. They have imams and mullahs and ayatollahs. These are title, you know, clergy titles. I guess ayatollah. Excuse me. I guess you'd say it's roughly equivalent to bishop. Right. Right. Whoops, there's another one. Yeah. No, there's a whole bunch of them. In fact, on Khomeini's Revolutionary Council, not all of the fellows, but a fair number of them on Khomeini's Revolutionary Council bear that title also. Well, if I see somebody else waving their hand, why, otherwise we'll let you monopolize. No, well, going, come on now, brain. Not Esau. Abraham and Hagar, Ishmael, right. See, the whole thing goes back to the fact that Abraham and his wife were promised children. And they got old and they didn't have children. And they basically questioned God on this point and took matters into their own hands. And so there was a taking of a concubine or a mistress or a illegitimate girlfriend or whatever you want to call it. And Ishmael was born. And that is why we have Islam. That's why we have trouble in the Mideast today. That's why there's been trouble in the Mideast for thousands of years. Oh, okay. You're thinking. Well, okay. Their line continued, but see, the way they interpret it is that Ishmael was the son of promise. They interpret Ishmael as the son of promise, so they and they interpret. Okay, so they've got Moses after there, and Moses was out of their direct lineage. But they still accept him as a prophet. I don't know of any of their, shall we say, their own people that they put up during that time frame. Can't think of anybody. No. No. Yes, in the back. Do you think that you can actually
But
no, okay, no, the religion itself did not directly start that way, but that race of people, what became the Arabic people, came out of the sin of Abraham and his wife and Hagar. You know, Ishmael. This race of people got started under less than auspicious circumstances. And then the background on the founding of Islam, I'm not a big authority on the historical background there, but basically the Arabic people in those days were very, very superstitious. They had a multiplicity of gods and a lot of little, you know, petty pagan gods and religions. And there was friction there between them and Judaism, and there was friction between them and Christianity. Yet you didn't have to be too much of a great thinker among their people to see that the religious development they had was pretty rotten. So out of this, Muhammad founded Islam and keyed it in on the idea of one God. Now, the identity of the one God and all this becomes another thing, but keyed it in on the idea of one God in reaction to the multiplicity of petty deities and that his people had at that time. Uh-huh, right.
And Allah was using another name for the God of Jehovah,
uh-huh.
The Jewish people.
That is the way that they interpret it. However, then they go on to deny basically his personal nature. They don't make him completely impersonal as the Hindus were, but he is so transcendent, so far removed, that there is no way that that we can deal with him. And they reject Jesus as a mediator there, as a way to deal with him. And so the prophet, Muhammad, becomes kind of a lower level mediator type thing. It's through the revelation of the prophet, it's through the writings of the prophet that we can obey Allah. In terms of coming into a relationship with him, they don't think in terms of a personal relationship with Allah at all. It's a religion of obedience. You obey thus, thus, and thus, and you will be rewarded with paradise. And they think in terms of a very materialistic paradise, you might say. I mean, they think in terms of maybe it comes out of their heritage and out of the difficulties that at least the Arabic Islamic people have had through a lot of years. You have to remember, right now, the Arabs are in the minority in Islam because it's spread down through India and it's spread down into the southeast, and so their big numbers are elsewhere. But still, when you think of Islam, you think of the founders and you think of Mecca and you think of Medina and you think of these places, so your common thought is Arabic, or at least North African there too. But they think in terms of paradise as, you know, a lush oasis and fruit trees and vegetables and beautiful women and, you know, everybody's got four and the whole bit, you know, and this goes on. And you're lying on a couch eating your grapes and your plums and, you know, one gal is fanning you and another gal is rubbing your neck and the whole works. That is, of course, the reward of being obedient to Allah in this life, and not being obedient, they do have a concept of punishment there and of being cut off.
And I guess
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Now remember, the Persian group is racially different than the Arabic group. There's a common alphabet there, but different languages and actually a different racial stock. Some similarities in racial stock, but it's different racial stock. But one thing that occurred to me pretty heavily about two and a half years back, and certainly I was no prophet in this regard, and I didn't know what was coming in Iran and all of that. But two and a half years ago, it occurred to me that Christianity has really been remiss in coming to grips with Islam, and that yes, it's a very, very difficult missionary area and all that, but on the other hand, we haven't been putting that much effort into it either. And there's, you know, a lot of people, you know, literally hundreds of millions of people tied up in Islam, and our efforts on their behalf have been quite puny. And I was thinking over that, and, you know, I just thought, hey, you know, we've really got to get it together in dealing with Islam. And unfortunately, there were two occurrences. First of all, I started doing a little bit more study in this area myself, a little more effort on my part, and I started building up my own reference library in this area. But I don't think I did enough in terms of the study and coming to grips with the situation. I don't think I built the library enough. And the second unfortunate thing is the events of the last 2 years have just proven me more right than I wanted to be. And now, a lot of elements of Christianity, a lot of leaders in the church, a lot of missionary leaders and all this, realize that there's a problem here and we've got to do more, and there are efforts afoot to do more. But it's something that should have been well underway a long time ago. Samuel Zwemer in the last century was a great Christian missionary to the Islamic people. And his place was taken in this century by William McElwee Miller. And of course there have been others, not quite so noted, but there needs to be thousands and tens of thousands of others. This is Miller's book, What is the Baha'i Faith? Now this book is actually an abridgment of a larger book. And let me read you the exact title of the larger book. If you're concerned about this area of the Baha'i faith, even if you don't want to go into it that much personally, but if you have a real concern here, you might pray very specifically that this book, The Baha'i Faith, Its History and Teachings, which is a 443-page book, and from it we get this abridgment, pray that that thing will come back into print. Because it was, just during the few years it was in print, it was just the magnum opus on the whole area of the Baha'is, Baha'i history. It was the best thing on Baha'i history done from any point of view. And certainly from the evangelical Christian point of view, it was the best thing done on the Baha'i faith. And it's out of print, and as far as I know, there's no plans to reprint it. And one of the good features of this book is that in the back, as an appendix, they had printed the entire English translation of the Most Holy Book, which was done about 20 years ago, but, you know, very limited edition printing and very, very hard to find. But then it was reprinted in the back of this thing on the Baha'i faith. And it's no longer available. We had them, and we were distributing them for a while, and I had my own personal copy, and I grabbed one for our reference library. The last one before I sold it, I just grabbed it and stuck it in the reference library, but things out of print. But this is through Erdmann's, and it's $4.95, and it's the best there is. It's based on the bigger work. This thing is a little 25-cent booklet. Again, it's a condensation of Miller's material. It's very, quote, rational. It's very democratic and equality of races, equality of sexes, equality of opportunity, pushes education, you know, so on and so on and so on. Sounds very, very nice. And it sounds, you know, they talk about accepting Buddha and accepting this religion and accepting that religion, and they make a real play there in terms of religious tolerance. Of course, you find that there's a limit to their religious tolerance, because say you're a Buddhist and you become a Baha'i, and you're real solid Buddhist and you're a member down at the Buddhist temple, and you get interested in the Baha'i faith and you like what they have to say about Buddha, and you're nice and tolerant yourself, so you like what they have to say about a couple of the other prophets, so you join the Baha'is. Then and only then you find out you have to sever your relations with the Buddhist temple. See, in their public teachings, they make it sound like you can have one foot in both camps. But when you come right down to it, you got to move into their camp completely. And it becomes, the PR thing is a religious tolerance. The reality is Baha'i is the successor to all the world's religions. Yes?
You didn't say why they have to drop Buddhism. Why they're required to drop.
Just because they don't want any, the organization doesn't want any divided loyalties. What? From testimonies of people that have been involved with it. And even if you dig far enough in their writings, this starts to come out too. It's not in their usual mail-out pamphlets and booklets, but... we have, in fact, I think we have some out on the table. We should have, still have two or three of them out there. And... As an Erdmann's publication, it should be available through any Christian bookstore. If you don't find it on the shelf, you can order it. And we're going to always be trying to keep them in stock, too. They talk about the nine different prophets, and on the surface, everything is one big happy family and complete tolerance, but when you get down to it, no divided loyalties. You got to follow this, this, this. And within, despite this talk about independent investigation of truth and all that, within the organization, there is a regimentation and a control over what they actually investigate and what lines they take. So there's the, there's the gap, as there is in many, many, many groups, regarding the teaching versus the reality. Okay. Okay, that's the question that comes up about once each session in one form or another. Let me say this. I don't think you can generalize and say there's one situation that covers all cases. And secondly, it's impossible with finality and authority to look inside, the heads and the minds of these men and come out and know exactly what's going on. But let me lay out some various possibilities, and I think most of the occurrences of this fall into one class or another. Some people get simply involved with the occult, and they have an occultic background. In other words, they're dealing with spiritism, or they're dealing with this or that. And this predisposes them at a later time to some experience or problem or whatever that they interpret as a spiritual thing or a religious thing. Other people come under a delusion either through their occultic background or simply through some mental imbalance that, such and such is real and I'm it. Others are motivated by human pride, search for power or control, or money, or a combination of those three. Some are what I call the entertainers. They like to tell stories, they like to entertain people or see how far they can go, see how far they're going to be believed. And, you know, they start out with it's kind of as a joke type thing, or something that they do to see how much attention they get. And they're more successful than they plan on being, and then later on get caught up in it themselves. I think Joseph Smith Jr., founder of the Mormons, probably falls into that category. He was a tremendous storyteller, a fantastic storyteller, and a great entertainer. And I think that he put out the Book of Mormon to get attention, and I think there was at least a limited financial element there, too. He wanted to get some attention, and he wanted to get some money. And he did better, especially in terms of the attention, than he ever dreamed of doing. And I think later on he got caught up in his own delusion. And for a while, you know, the thing snowballed, and so he had to kind of go along with it and build on it and build on it, you know, to stay ahead of the snowball. And then after a while he just got caught up in his own delusion. That's what I believe happened in his case. In the case of Muhammad, I don't know if the historical evidence, there's enough historical evidence there to draw too many conclusions one way or the other. He did have quite a number of alleged visions, and he supposedly got information through these visions, which he did not write down himself. Actually, he did not write the Quran, but he related verbally information that he got in these visions to his followers, and they wrote it down and compiled the Quran from that. No, it's smaller than the Bible. It's maybe about the size of the New Testament. The most holy book, this thing in the Baha'i faith, is smaller than that. Whereas the Bayan, the original, shall we say, Bible, with the Babi thing or the Baha'i faith, was, I don't know, about 19 volumes. Well, it was, I don't know what you'd call too much trouble, but let's face it, history just wasn't focused there at all. The people, I mean, they just were not in the mainstream, economically, culturally, or anything. And about the highest expression that they had was the fact that the people engaged in commerce and trade. That was about the highest, you know, advancement there. Culturally, things were very crude, and religiously, they were even worse. And they just weren't catching any attention at all in the world.
You know, historically, that was in Babylon. There was a desert, that whole area. Were they related also to the Abraham descendants, or was that a different race of people that they include?
This probably, remember, Abraham came up from Ur of the Chaldees. So these people were, I mean, Abraham apparently came out of that stock. Instead of them coming from Abraham, it was the other way around. Abraham came out of that, and then Ishmael on the one hand, and Isaac on the other. From Abraham.
Oh, it was amazing. Ishmael had 12.